Hello, friends and folks, and welcome to the second episode of our Final Fantasy VII Rebirth book club. I'm Six Detmar.
I'm Jennifer Unkle.
I'm Kyrie Page.
And this week we blazed through chapters 3, 4, and 5 of FF7 Rebirth. I will go ahead and start us off with a summary. It is reasonably long because, you know, it's 3 chapters of a long game. Things happen.
Yep. Some stuff definitely happened in this section.
Still slightly rattled from the conclusion of last chapter's boss fight against Midgar Swarmer, the party advances into a mithril mine that leads to the city of Junon, in pursuit of the men in black cloaks and the mysterious connection to Sephiroth. Along the way, Barret reveals his pre-revolutionary life as a miner, though he's disinclined to provide details. A chance encounter with the Turks turns into a fight and an impromptu introduction of the newest member of their team. Standing in for Reno, who is on sick leave. Staying in for Reno, who is on sick leave, is Elena, a hot-tempered young woman and, in the game's own terms, petite powerhouse. The party corners her in Rude, but the timely intervention of Turk's commander Sang pushes the fight to even again. In the chaos, Elena throws a grenade at our heroes, and the Turks make good their escape, stating they're willing to turn a blind eye to Avalanche as long as they stay out of each other's way. After some dungeon crawling and puzzle solving, the party emerges from the cave onto the shoreline leading up to the Shinra-run city of Junon. Access to the upper levels is restricted, and so the gang heads to Under Junon, a poor fishing village living in the literal shadow of the big city. They rescue a young girl from a monster attack who turns out to be Wutaian agent and Kunoichi Yuffie Kisaragi. She expresses both gratitude for the save and her respect for the Midgar branch of Avalanche, aka the party, and their willingness to take drastic action. She, too, is here to take drastic action, in the form of an assassination of Shinra's new president, Rufus Shinra. She parts ways with the party quickly. She has her mission, and they have theirs. Infiltrating Upper Junon, the party decides to infiltrate the parade, being held in honor of Rufus's inauguration, and get answers from the man directly. They split up, with Barret and Red 13 on scouting duty, while Cloud, Tifa, and Aerith go undercover as Shinra's soldiers. They are immediately pulled aside by the commander of the squad they are impersonating, and in a humorous series of events, Cloud ends up becoming the parade leader for the Midgar 7th Infantry, commanding them through a series of elaborate rifle drills in hopes of winning a commendation from the president. Meanwhile, one of the men in black cloaks visits Rufus Shinra in his office, claiming to be an envoy from Wutai, and insisting Rufus play his part in some mysterious plan. Cloud is ultimately successful in leading the 7th to an award, and he, Tifa, and Aerith are personally called up to the podium by Rufus himself. Rufus reveals he's had eyes on them the whole time, but this is in fact a fortunate meeting for them, because he wants to offer them a deal. Rufus is willing to call off all Shinra pursuit of Avalanche and Aerith if they agree to stay away from Midgar and hunt down Sephiroth. This is exactly what Cloud wanted to do anyway, and so he readily agrees. The deal sours when Yuffie attacks from above, failing to assassinate Rufus but injuring his right-hand man, Heidegger. Rufus incorrectly assumes the party's involvement in the assassination and cancels the deal while all scramble for cover. The rest of the group runs for a ship to escape, but Cloud is unable to slip away from the unaware and loyal members of the Midgar 7th Infantry. They insist on accompanying him as he fights his way through Shinra soldiers, as it is an open conversation there are traitors in their midst, and the 7th Infantry wouldn't dream of questioning Cloud's loyalty, except as a joke at one point. Cloud and the 7th head to meet Roche, the eccentric soldier 3rd class on a motorcycle who fought Cloud in 7 Remake, and who chased the party down while they were in Under Junon to issue Cloud a challenge. After an intense arena fight, Cloud prevails, and in respect, Roche gives him a prize and allows him to leave. After a tense, confused conversation with the 7th Infantry, Cloud convinces them that he is on a different mission, and they part ways. He meets up with the party, and they board the Shinra 8, a cruise ship bound for the vacation town of Costa del Sol, in pursuit of the man in black cloaks. The cruise seems uneventful at first, with the only excitement being a shipwide tournament for the collectible card game Queen's Blood. However, that night, fiends attack the ship, swarming and breaking into the lower levels. Cloud and company fight off as many as they can, but a few particularly strange fiends absorb some of the men in black cloaks and transform into more horrifying and powerful monsters. In an attempt to stop the constant transformations, the captain of the ship shoots a bunch of men in black cloaks in the head. Instead of stopping them, it simply triggers a different sort of transformation as the men merge and transform into Genova Emergent, which Cloud seems to hallucinate as Sephiroth. After the fight, Barrett and Tifa exchange concerned looks over Cloud's apparent hallucinations, but decide to leave it at that for now.
I mean, they saw the Men in Black cloaks turn into Genova as well, I imagine.
Right, but Cloud's the one who saw Genova as Sephiroth.
Right.
They did not see that.
Right, because at first I was thinking when we got... We're going to skip around a little bit, I guess. But real quick, I thought for a second that the entire fight happened in Cloud's mind for a moment. But no, it was... They had the fight, but Cloud is the only one who saw Sephiroth appear before him.
Mm-hmm. Because you had the previous fight against another Genova form in 7 Remake, and everyone else experienced that one. Mm-hmm. So, it's just like, no, Genova turns to... Cloud is having a... I hate to reference this game that I don't care for, but a Song of Saya situation where he's imagining tentacled, like, ethereal beasts as just normal people.
Let's start at the top.
Rewind the clock.
Big snake. We beat the big snake, and then we go into the mines, and we have this protracted sequence in which... So, I in the last episode mentioned that I had some friction with the open world stuff, and I just appreciated the mine sequence because it was this focused thing. It was this focused linear thing. I thought, yes, I am comfortable and I am safe.
I was not super hot on the mines myself. They were fine. They were a pretty generic dungeon, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of shooting rocks.
Right.
Which was...
That was weird.
That was weird.
I did appreciate that sequence, if only because it reminded me that Barrett, who I was neglecting in previous chapters, is one of the best party members in the whole game. So it was like, oh, right, he could just get shit done. He's great.
Oh, yeah. No, Aerith, Aerith.
Aerith, oh, dear.
Barrett, at certain parts of the game, I am using more than Cloud. Barrett is really good.
Barrett is great.
And really versatile, right? Like, Barrett's specialties are like, okay, unlike some people, he is equally good at attacking, like, ground and, like aerial opponents. He does decent DPS. He has great tools for building up stagger and, like, sort of capitalizing on burst moments. He's very tanky. He kind of has it all.
Yeah, and here's the other thing that why Barrett is now like a staple in my party. He builds ATB so fast. It's so fast. And the ability to have that ATB ready for just about anything, item healing or casting a spell or something like that. Barrett is so versatile. It's so good.
My party has been... When I've had the option, has been kind of locked to Cloud, Aerith, Barrett.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of like the trio that I've been sticking with.
I could imagine like swapping out Aerith for Red 13, because I think they did a pretty good job making Red 13 a compelling character with his, like, you know, parry and revenge stance stuff. I think that's fun. And then he has some good, Cosmo Ray and stuff, some good AoEs. I hold by the idea that Tifa is just the most half-developed character who is not fun to play, which is a shame.
Yeah, like, when we got to, like, when I got to the Genova fight, or the Genova Emergent fight, and I was stuck with Tifa, I was like, oh dear, oh boy, she's not completely dead weight, mind you, but... It was a little frustrating.
The funniest part of that Genova Emergent fight is when the whole tentacle situation starts happening again from, like, just like it did in Remake. And Barrett's the one who complains about it, but Barrett's also the one who can just eliminate the tentacles instantly. You just aim and shoot, and each one of them only takes, like, a second to go down. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Or you already have Genova Immersion at such low health that you're like, I don't care, and you hit overcharge and she dies. not the hardest. I think I'm curious if this was just a weird coincidence. Cloud fucking, I was controlling Barrett that whole fight, and it was very easy, except for the fact that Cloud spent the whole fight on Death's Door.
No, that happened to me too.
I kept switching between Cloud and Barrett, so I was basically micromanaging both of them, so that wasn't he wasn't constantly about to die for me.
I wonder if it's the case that they, like, well, Cloud's the main character. We assume the player's going to be spending most of the time as Cloud, so Cloud's AI isn't as good or something, because he was just eating shit.
I
kept, like, having to spend ATB to heal Boy up so he didn't, you know, collapse on the ground.
What I noticed was during that fight, so when we got to the Upper Junon section, when the game prompts you, hey, you won't be able to go back to the open world for a while, it shows, mm-hmm. you know, the recommended level is 24. I was at level 25, so I was doing okay. But I got to the Genova Emergent fight, and for a hot second, I thought it was one of those doomed battles that RPGs like to do every now and again, mm-hmm. because fucking Genova Emergent would have this beam that took out like 2/3 of my health in one hit.
Oh. You can roll.
I figured that out eventually. Thank you.
I was level 28. It was not a problem.
Yeah. I kind of found that fight a little disappointing just because you're immediately going to compare it to the Genova fight in Remake, and that one is so much more interesting. But I did like the little twist that they had on this particular version of the song with a lot more vocal chanting.
Yeah, I mean, the fight in Remake against a Genova creature is really at a very climactic moment, and this is, like, I guess the climax of Chapter 5, but Chapter 5's kind of a nothing. Like, they're slipping a major encounter into a filler episode to try and make it feel more important.
Mm-hmm. Right, because most of that episode is a card game tournament.
Which, listen, I had fun.
I had fun too, to be clear.
Okay, did you solve your QB problems?
Yep, I did.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll get into that.
Yeah. But yeah, you fight your way through the mines. Go ahead.
I was just gonna mention, within the mines, when they mentioned that Reno was on vacation, I do know that Reno just disappears every once in a while in 7 on PS1, but that line in particular at that particular moment just made me think about how Keiji Fujiwara died before this game, and they more or less had to use archival audio for his entire presence in this game, and that made me kind of sad.
Think it may be the case that because of how long of a tail game development has nowadays, when did he die? He died in 2021, I think? No.
I believe he died, like, right after Remake came out.
Huh.
Yeah, 2020.
2020, okay. I mean, it is entirely possible that he had an opportunity to record his lines, because, again, game development is very long nowadays. But
6 days after the release of Remake.
Gosh.
I don't think he had time.
Yeah. They mentioned in an interview at some point that they had to write around that and basically give Reno a reduced presence in this and just work with the audio they already had.
Mm-hmm. I guess the idea of, like, long development tales was on my mind because Grand Blue Fantasy Relink came out earlier this year, mm-hmm. and I saw a tweet by Kira Buckland, who she usually tweets whenever she has a voice role in a new game. She recently tweeted about, like, Unicorn Overlord and things like that, but I remember a tweet in which she said, yeah, I'm really excited that Grand Blue Fantasy Relink came out, finally, I recorded my lines in 2017.
Yeah. But sometimes you do get those.
Yeah. But then again, that may have been just a unique case because the development of Grand Blue Fantasy Relink is, I hope against like the tendency of Japanese game developers, I want a post-mortem on that game.
It seems like it was a bit of a train wreck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Neither here nor there. We're in the mines, though. We're still there.
Yeah, we haven't left yet. It's mostly just a lot of monster fights. You do get to fight against the Turks. I think having Elena here is a good choice because I feel like Reyno and Rude are both solved, right? Like, their combat strategies, unless they learn some pretty dramatically new tricks, mm-hmm. It's like, okay, the thing with Reyno is you go into Punisher and just parry his shit. And the thing with Rude is you, like, backdash and smash him with magic. And introducing a new Turk who has different weaknesses and different needs a different approach mm-hmm. is beneficial. Elena's position historically in the Turks, and, you know, a lot of things that I'm learning. When I played Final Fantasy VII, I hadn't watched a ton of anime. And also, the game didn't have voice acting.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that people say about, like, oh, I can't believe they changed this character in this way, right? Like, I can't believe they made this change to Tifa. I think that's been the case the whole time. It's just that because we didn't have the anime experience and it wasn't voice acted, we could see something different in it. But a lot of these characters, I think, are just what they were always supposed to be. And Elena was always supposed to be like, oh, this spunky young kid. And it's pretty condescending.
Mm.
I do like her boss fight dynamic with the situation, because unlike the Reyno Rude fights, you see Rude more or less coordinating a whole lot with Elena and acting as a shield for her as she powers up and just generally getting into moves like that.
Yeah. And I think there's a fun, like, Reyno and Rude are both like melee characters, and, you know, that meant that their fights were kind of like, it worked because Reyno, you wanted to get up close and parry, but Rude, you wanted to stay away so he didn't command grab you. And so it was like, do you want to get close against one but not close against the other? That dynamic is different here because Elena is like a backline fighter mostly. She does, obviously, she has the charge up ability, petite powerhouse, as I referenced, mm-hmm. where she just sort of goes ham for a second. But mostly she jumps back and throws grenades, right?
Right.
And I think that you're right that dynamic of like Rude as like covering for her is kind of fun in the fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a good time doing that fight. Again, I mostly watched a Jen play a remake, the first part of this. Mm-hmm. So me going into the Elena and Rude fight was me kind of figuring out Rude's mechanics and also Elena. But I found that fight pretty fun, just in general. It was challenging, but it was fun to figure out that stuff that I hadn't experienced in Remake. So, like I said, a lot of this stuff is new to me, so I enjoyed that fight. Also, I like the fights more, also especially because I figured out synergy moves since the last time we recorded.
Yeah, I leaned into those harder this time after some of Jen's comments about how crucial they were. And I think they do a really good job of like fleshing out characters that need a little more going on, right? And having some fun. The problem is, listen, we all know that there's like an affection meter and that's going to affect the Golden Saucer. And I don't want it to be Aerith, but I'm just using Firework Blade all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could always do what M did and just be a fucking dick to Aerith every time you talk to her, and that'll ensure that you don't end up with her in the Gold Saucer.
The problem is there's no good, the way they're portraying this, there's no good option for me. Because I don't know. I'm making some assumptions, right? Because we haven't gotten to this point yet. But like, the scene with Barrett is originally played for like homophobic comedy, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
The scene with Aerith is like sad because she's chasing after this like phantom of her boyfriend that Cloud is actually not. The scene with Tifa, I'm not super into because I think their relationship is not very interesting. And so I could go for Yuffie, but in this game, Yuffie is portrayed as like a fucking child.
You could go for Red 13.
Oh, is that an option in this one? That wasn't in the original.
I'm pretty sure he is part of the Gold Saucer. I'm pretty sure he's part of the Gold Saucer equation in this game.
Okay,
I mean,
maybe.
You do get there. Red 13 does have a relationship circle above his head, and certain like if I am assuming this correctly, whoever you have the highest affection with will be who you do the ride with.
I was assuming that it was still like from the list of options from the original, because I'm also assuming that this isn't the only thing that affection meter does, but I guess I don't know that. Hasn't done anything else so far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten to the Gold Saucer yet, so we cannot say definitively how that will play out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It'll probably be a couple of episodes before we do. Get out of the mines. Okay, so the men in the black cloaks. This is going to be a concern for a while,
yep.
Right? Because it's just like every... Go ahead.
One moment before we talk about Men in Black Cloaks. Song does show up at the end, and it just underlines
Sang.
How much...
Sang, not song.
Oh, because in the English version, they pronounce it song.
It's got an E in it. I don't know why they do that.
These are the cat Sith people. You can't trust them.
True.
Anyway, Sang shows up, and... just really reinforces why I think the way they portray the Turks in this is really weird, because Sang does call off the others like in the original, but just given the way he's portrayed in Remake and Crisis Core and stuff like that, when he's being like, look after Aerith for me, will you? It's much more of a... Yeah, you got her sort of situation, other than like the sinister nature of him saying that in the original.
This might be a voice acting thing. I definitely got the vibes of like, I'll let you hold on to this prize for a little while longer, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't feel very supportive to me in Japanese.
Yeah, he's very... I'm still puzzling this character out a little bit, but I did not get the... I get the feeling about him that he has, like most characters in this game, they have their own plans going on.
And I mean, there's a big thing, like, a lot of this is all influenced by Advent Children, right? Advent Children, a deeply influential work on Square Enix and their output, even though it was bad and didn't do very well. But in that, the Turks are portrayed as like, no, you don't understand, they've always been these heroes. It's just, listen, they happen to be on the other side, and they, you know, were going along with some bad things, but they know better now, and they were always good people. And it's like, no, that's not true.
That's not how this works.
That's basically every post Final Fantasy VII piece of media that they've done, like in Crisis Core especially, like Sang's just your friend, and the way that he talks about Aerith is in a very caring, sort of loving way, and he does his best to save Zack in Crisis Core.
I mean, I didn't play far enough in Crisis Core. I assume you mean like once like Zack has betrayed Shinra, right?
Yes, but also like when Zack is going on dates with Aerith, and I think they just mentioned a few times Sang's relationship, and they portray him as more of a caring guardian than like someone who is particularly watching over her so Hojo can do more shit to her.
I mean, Stockholm Syndrome goes two ways. I think it is easy for someone who is holding someone against their will to convince themselves that they are being kind.
Or that this is in the best interest of the person that they are, keeping in captivity.
Mm-hmm. So, like, saying being, like, weirdly affectionate to Aerith doesn't bother me, because I think that totally tracks with him being a person who kidnaps people for a living.
Yeah, I guess in the end I just was bothered by the way they play saying out to be a hero by the end of Crisis Core. But yeah.
Sure, I mean,
like you said, this is post-Advent Children stuff relating around the Turks. Like, wasn't there a whole game where it's just you're playing as the Turks?
Before Crisis, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very funny that they are acting like all those games were canon. Because if that's true, like, there was a giant, like, mothership-sized weapon that attacked Midgar and was defeated by the Turks right before this game started, and no one talks about it.
And there's, like, three or four other Turks that just haven't come up yet.
I mean, we're gonna meet one of them, but...
Yeah, true. The Black Cloaks.
Yeah, and just with the Turks, I mean, like, I feel like it's summed up in their theme, right? Where they have another, like, remix of a classic FF7 theme, musical theme, I mean. And it is fine. But in the original, it was this, like, very, like, slick and menacing song about, like, these cool people who are here to fuck up your shit. And eventually became comic relief because you beat them so consistently. And then it turned in a different good way. But now they're just, listen, heroes on both sides.
Heroes on both sides we'll be getting back to over the course of this podcast.
Won't we just?
Won't we?
So, the men in the black cloaks.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, these are people who have been treated with Genova cells. In the original, they were like basically failed Sephiroth clones, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of. I think the stuff they've done with, like, meeting people who are ex-soldiers and are having, like, bad symptoms, like the guy from the inn in Calm, or, like, one of the dudes who runs a random business here in Junon, right? That stuff kind of works for me. But, one, I always thought the failed Sephiroth clones just wandering around mumbling, even in the original, was kind of dumb. It's especially dumb to be like, okay, if you were going hunting, right? Let's say you are an old, like, an old-timey hunter who, like, you know, rides on a horseback and has, like, a dog, hunting hound, right?
Big mustache, mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, I'm going to hunt a bear. That's a big, most dangerous game. Let's hunt a bear. If your dog moved it 1 mile per fucking hour, it wouldn't work. How are you going to follow these guys to anything at the speed they move? Sephiroth will be gone every time, even if he takes a... This is like the tortoise and the hare, but if the tortoise were going backwards, what are we doing?
Well, they're all heading towards a specific destination. But yeah, it was especially noticeable when we got, like, to the end of our chapters, and you just see them looking at a mountain trying to figure out how to get to it. Like, they're portrayed in this comedic sort of, like... I don't think they're trying to be comedic with it, but just the way that they move super slowly and just seem to have little regard for their safety, like they're lemmings or something, it's really weird.
It's so weird. Like, and another thing, so far, the way the men in black robes are portrayed, which sounds like it's consistent with that original game, is that they go around mumbling everywhere. And mm-hmm. I think about, I don't know, we get to the end of chapter 4, and we have a black robe boarding this ship. Does he have a ticket? Does he, like, spend most of his time mumbling, and then it goes, yes, I have a ticket for the B class? You know, something like that? Like, what is going on?
I mean, they sort of, like, sweep it under the rug by having them, like, walk up behind our heroes who are negotiating their way onto the ship. And the guy's like, oh, they must be with you. But it's like, their existence in this world doesn't... It made sense in the original because you would just, like, find them in corners. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, they're just standing in a corner and everyone is ignoring them. That's fine.
Yeah, they're weird cultists, so who cares? Everybody ignores them.
But, like, I mean, I don't... One of them fucking, like, goes to debate with Rufus. What is going on?
And for that one in particular, they kind of, they play into some of the twist situation within Final Fantasy VII on the PS1, where this guy removes his cloak and he kind of looks like an aged up Cloud with, like, the way that his hair is colored and some of the facial features.
But also, he's just being a joker. Because I guess they decided they wanted a Joker.
So, yeah, I was going to ask that flashback scene. Is that in any of the Final Fantasy VII media you have seen, Six, where Rufus is just like, but I fucking killed you, and it shows a shot of him killing him.
I'm willing to bet that's an intergrade cutscene.
No, I didn't see that there.
I do not remember, right? I just don't remember. I don't know, it could easily be something they've inserted into their fucking mobile game Ever Crisis. I don't know.
Everything's but canon this... and nothing is canon at the same time.
Yeah, it's I don't they're doing it's a stupid conceit. This is for folks at home. This is the episode where I'm like, actually, I think they're fucking this up. Is sort of my broad arc.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's so many character bits I want to get into that are like, oh, this is not how humans act. This is not how these characters are supposed to act. This is wrong.
I kind of wanted to bring that up. So let's like kind of let's get into it.
Do you
want
to get to Under Junon?
It's pronounced an Under Junon for sure.
Yeah. So we get to Under Junon and it's like, oh, man, how are we going to get up the elevator? We need to find a way to get up the elevator. And you run in circles. If you're me, you run in circles for 20 minutes because the objective marker is incredibly unclear.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally it's like, go downstairs. And you're like, I did. I'm like, well, you didn't go to the right part of downstairs. I'm like, cool. Okay.
Gotta go to the end first.
So before I even went over there, like, I had tried to fast travel over to the grasslands and the game wouldn't let me until it was like, oh, you gotta complete some stuff before you do that. So I ended up going through this whole extended side quest where this chocobo farmer's cart broke. So I had to tame this chocobo using an elaborate stealth sequence involving moving different crates. This chocobo gave me the ability to walk up walls. So I went to talk to a person who could build the replacement parts. He said, no, you have to go around the area and pick up these three other parts.
Driftwood.
And once you do that... Yeah, once you get the driftwood, you get the materials you need, and then you can go to the Chocobo Ranch, then his cart gets rebuilt, and then you can travel back and forth between the grasslands and there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I did every open world activity and quest in both areas by the end of our playtime today. So.
Huh. Okay.
I will report back on some of that stuff. I feel like I want to get through like the main plot events and then double back to talk about like open world optional shit, because some of us, I think, won't have stuff to say about some of those events because we didn't see all of them, right?
Yeah.
I did some of that stuff. There is one that I'll have things to say about for sure. But regardless, let us continue.
So... this is one of their first big changes, is that Yuffie is no longer an optional party member. She's plot important.
Mm-hmm.
Yuffie is there, you know, as like sort of as a Wutaian agent, but not expressly. It seems like she sort of like went off on her own because she was tired of them like being like, patience, we have to wait for the right moment. And she's like, fuck that, I'm a child. I'm gonna get impatient and go do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that this is necessarily like the thing is in Final Fantasy VII, she didn't get a lot of characterization because she was an optional party member.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so very often it's just that she didn't have anything to say in scenes. And she came across as this, like, mischievous, somewhat scheming, I mean, certainly young lady, right? But I didn't get the impression she was, like, 16 or whatever the fuck she is here.
Yeah, like...
And it's weird.
I don't find that part weird so much just because, like, I feel like she acts her age more or less, and it's fun to basically... She does that bit to try and impress the other members of Avalanche, and their response is like, well, aren't assassins kind of terrible people? Isn't that all you do? You just kill people? And...
It's Barrett that says that.
Yeah,
bro, what the fuck are you talking about?
When I got to that, I was like, Barrett, aren't you a noted eco-terrorist? Like, don't you know what needs to be done?
It does lead to the very funny moment, though, where Yuffie is like, no, that's a bad assumption, but I guess we do kill people, too. That's part of our job, because we're a ninja.
Sure, it's a fine, very basic, like, joke, right? About, like, hey, that's the stereotype. It's correct, but it's a stereotype. And, like, sure, that's fine. But, like, it cuts to one of the core problems of this fucking game and remake, where they're like, you know, our main characters are revolutionaries, except for if they try to hurt anyone changing things, that's no good. And I'm like, shut the fuck up!
Yeah, like, it is so weird that in Chapter 4, like, you have those moments where Barrett is... like, apprehensive to the idea of potentially assassinating the president of the power company that's killing the Earth.
To the point where he and the other party members more or less foil Yuffie's in-progress assassination.
I mean, they don't really. Yuffie has a bad throw.
Well, they see it coming and they're like, they tell them to, like, get down or whatever.
Do they? I don't think so. I think... Barrett is
Heidegger does a get down, Mr. President.
Yeah, he does that. And what Barrett is doing is, like, he wants to stop Yuffie for some reason. Maybe his thinking is like, okay, there'll be another opportunity, but it's like, I don't know, this seems like a pretty prime opportunity.
No, I think it's just his stupid, like, fucking, like, assassinations are bad. And, like, no, they are not. Like, yes, assassination is a political tool that can be used incorrectly, but, like, I actually think it's used correctly more often than not.
Well, also the situation is they're basically confronting him in front of thousands of Shinra soldiers. If that went through and suddenly he got murked by a member of Wutai... and by extension, Avalanche, since the two of them kind of work together on certain projects, they'd be pretty much fucked because there'd be 1,000 soldiers coming down on them.
But why doesn't that happen?
Yeah, that's the other thing that's, like, weird about this fucking chapter. At the beginning of this chapter, you do get the prompt. Like, I'm going into Upper Junon. And I thought for a second, like, oh, we're doing the, like, kind of tense music being played. Is this going to be a stealth sequence or something? Because we've had these before. Because I have noted eco-terrorists, Barrett and Tifa, following me around. But no, you could just kind of go around this secure military base. Supposedly secure because everybody's distracted about the fucking parade or whatever. But it's and you still have to infiltrate it, though, but it's like, guys, what are we doing?
You have to infiltrate it when you've already run through it for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Spent 10 minutes running through, like, hangars and launch bays filled with soldiers and, like, fighter craft, and behind them is a lady with big boobs and a tank top just jogging through.
Right.
What the fuck is happening?
I saw a soldier, and I was like, okay, maybe this will be a thing, but I just walk in front of him, and he has nothing to say.
They do address this, though. Like,
do they?
Yes. There is a scene where we cut to Rufus's office as this is happening, and they're watching Cloud and the others fuck about in Upper Junon, and it's very clear that everyone... that everyone within the chain of command knows who they are, knows what they're doing, but is like, well, we want to cut a deal with them, so just let them be.
That's not how organizations work.
Also, counterpoint, right? Why would Avalanche, why would the party have any, like, why would the party not act like they are infiltrating a highly secure location? Like, why doesn't the party try to avoid sight lines and things like that? Because they don't know that they're being let through.
They don't know that they're being let through. Also, I don't think there's any reason the soldiers should know that they're letting them through from the way things play out. Like, sure, if Rufus and Heidegger know this is going on and saying, okay,
but every like, soldier?
Like Junon, 5th Infantry member number 182, does not know this.
Yeah, that part before they get to the uniforms, yeah, I agree, is a bit weird. But they do get to the uniforms.
You should see Barrett and Tifa be like, oh, it's on site.
I mean, I could also bet that Junon, 5th Infantry number 182, does not know what these people look like.
Well, we have...
That would be fine.
That'd be... Okay. Sure.
I don't understand why it's... Like, you could have at least had it be like they come up in, like, a part of the dock that is, like, normally civilian but is restricted right now, and thus there's like, okay, you guys have to get out of here, and on the way they duck into a side room. Having them specifically run through the military is bizarre, but it whatever, right? They do then get the uniforms.
Sure. That they're just allowed to have.
Though in terms of them not recognizing, like, even the lady from Lower Junon has a poster with every single party member's face on it that has a bounty out for them. And sure. She calls it in, and Roach appears, and Roach is like, hey there, stud, we're gonna go, I'm challenging you to a duel, I better see you topside in a bit.
Yeah, that does happen. We'll
get to Roach.
We'll get to some, because it gets more confusing, and like, what are we fucking doing? You get the uniforms, and like, this whole bit is excessive, but I do think it actually is kind of in the spirit of classic Final Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, classic Final Fantasy does have, like, random weird minigames that are required to progress the plot, does have these weird little comedy arcs in the middle of serious things. And I think the parade minigame, like, is all right to play. I think the way they use camera angles for difficulty is kind of cheap bullshit.
Yeah.
But the concept here, I mean, like, it is kind of evocative of the honeybee in sequence mechanically, but what you're actually doing here is first what starts off as a very tongue-in-cheek, careful, but, like, snide parody of, like, marine, like, rifle, like, display routines, and then turns into, like, you do the Bahamut formation, and your members, like, form a little star with their arms around out and spin in the circle, and I'm like, this is the funniest, like, this is such a good parody of military pomp and circumstance. This actually whips.
I do love the detail during the parade, too. Where Rufus is told, hey, if you fire that cannon, it's on site with Wutai, they're just gonna come after you again. And because he wants a war with Wutai, he's like, yeah, we're just gonna go ahead and do it. So when he's out in his limousine and riding amongst the people, he stops in the middle of the area, calls the cannon strike out, and all of the civilian populace are just like, whoa, they're really bringing out all the stops for this new guy. This is great. Not realizing that they're witnessing a war starting right there.
Yeah, it's I think that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a good opportunity to, like, show off the cannon, which, I mean, I think in the original, their approach to the Sister Ray, as it's called, the Junon cannon, is, like, it's this big looming thing. It's like, you know, what if, like, you know, Chekhov's gun was like 500 times as big. He was like, Jesus. You're always waiting for it to become relevant. But again, this being a remake, we don't have that same level of, like, anticipation, because you know kind of where this is probably going. And so having it fire here to sort of show like that Rufus is extremely eager to fuck around and perhaps find out is, I think, an effective move.
Mm-hmm. Plus, also, it is a funny detail to me, anyway, when you are going around recruiting all the soldiers, which I recruited all 10 groups because, like, I wanted to see their scenes. But one of them mm-hmm. is they are looking at Sister Rey model kits, and you tell them, like, okay, break time's over. But
in Japanese, they specifically call it a master grade. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, you also get the weird scene, though, where you infiltrate the bald person club, where they break into song for a bit, and it's another moment where they're kind of humanizing Rude, because he, in sync, does the rubbing bald head motion that everyone else does.
Yeah, again, this is classic Final Fantasy in a way that I haven't necessarily liked historically. It's just like the not that funny, but just extreme absurdist, like, jokes scattered throughout. I'm like, this isn't that funny, and I feel like it breaks character in a way that, like, it's not like a problem, but it does intentionally take me out of the moment for the sake of a joke I don't even think is very funny.
It does also present, there's an interesting aesthetic clash that's going on that is, so when you're going around doing the scenes in which you are recruiting the different soldiers, every time you recruit them, they do this, like, really comically exaggerated marching motion. And I'm starting to run into this issue where characters will be doing stuff that wouldn't be out of place in a cartoony or very anime style thing.
Or very low res, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you run into that. But with the amount of fidelity we're dealing with now, with characters looking relatively realistic, granted, there's still a lot of anime stylings, like people's eyes aren't that big, for example. It's so that we can avoid dipping straight into the uncanny valley. But it is still a weird clash to have these soldiers doing this weird bald head dance that wouldn't be out of place in a chibi art style or the art style of the original game, because you could exaggerate a lot of stuff there. But here it's like seeing the realistic models do something like that is starting to... It feels weird. I'm starting to notice it.
Yeah, I definitely think that, like, the cartoony, like, Ministry of Silly Walks shit we have going on here was like, okay, this worked on PS1. It does not work here.
We're on PS5, baby.
6, did you happen to go into the jazz bar while you were recruiting the various troops?
You have to.
Okay. Yeah, because I was wondering when you were in that jazz bar on the second level. Did you recognize the song that they were playing? Because I did not.
I didn't, no.
Okay. Yeah, I figured it was a classic Final Fantasy VII track that they were jazzing up like they've done a few times already.
Most likely.
If they change it enough, I tend not to. Like, there, do you remember that, like, the when we did Novel Not New on Final Fantasy 15, and you had the, like, the cover of Battle on the Big Bridge, and I couldn't recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
When they go really far out of their way with the remakes, I tend not to be able to tell anymore. So.
Ah, okay.
So I probably wouldn't have known. Anyway, we're going to skip back to where we were, right? In podcast res, where you have failed the negotiation with Rufus because Yuffie attacks, right? And as you say, Barrett's like, we got to stop the assassination, because what if we were, like, the bad guy and we were suddenly known to be the bad guy in the middle of a horde of soldiers? That's still what happens. Rufus still is like, oh, this is your fault. Fuck you guys. And you're standing in front of thousands of soldiers and no one does anything and you just leave.
Even if... These thousands of soldiers have prop weapons, because typically when you have these military displays, they tend to use prop weapons for this sort of thing. The fact that after an attempted assassination attempt in front of all these soldiers, that these soldiers do not swarm you instantly to beat your ass is like Rufus and Heidecker, like, just go like, okay, deal's off. Do they not sit? Like, they don't, like... Yeah, you're just allowed to walk out to a certain degree.
Not only that, so much do they not, like, set the hounds on you. They apparently spread the information that there are people in Shinra uniforms who were part of the assassination, but they don't, like, name names or point at people to the point that you're able to just join back up with the Seventh? And this sequence is the most confused part of this play today, and perhaps of the game so far, where you are going through Junon with the Midgar 7th Infantry following along with you, and it is played as this, like confused but, like, heartwarming thing that they're like, we're loyal with you to the end, sir. And it's like, you are implicating these people in really intense treason by having them help you murder other Shinra soldiers. And then at the end of the sequence, they just do the, like, will I ever see you again? Like, it's a fucking romance novel. What the fuck are you doing?
Another thing. So, okay, there is... I thought, like, I understood, like, the type of story that this game is going for, because you have this bit where Rufus goes, cut the feed, right? And I mm-hmm. thought, after the attempt, you would think you would have Rufus go, turn the feed back on, and just put Plaster Cloud's image in front of everywhere and just instantly break the disguise.
Mm, yeah.
Like, you would think, by having that setup of, okay, there's an active camera feed on this podium, you would think they would re-trigger it to, you know, create some tension in this scene.
I just don't understand the point of any... Like, I get the moment of being like, no, the Seventh isn't just going to let this go. But everything that happens from there makes no fucking sense. Like, it makes no sense, like, logically as events to happen. And it also isn't like they're bending logic to serve the story, because I don't know what the fuck this is doing for the story besides confusing things.
Mm-hmm. Also, the Seventh turned into another minigame at this point, because the text more or less says... Yeah, if their health drops to zero, they'll die. And the game is more or less expecting you to use potions in other situations to keep them healthy till you get to Roach.
And I did, because I was like, well. I mean, like, I, you know, they basically told me to. I don't, like, I didn't seem clear that I wasn't going to fail, but I was like, I want to keep these people alive, and, like, I could see a version where if some of them have died, like, the dialogue changes, and I need to see what you think the ideal outcome is here, because, like, listen, okay, if you're a revolutionary and you are undercover, you are going to meet people who are working for the bad guys who seem like perfectly nice people, and you're going to have to fuck them over, and I'm sorry. That's the cost of revolution. If the pop-up text there had been, like, fight your way to, you know, the thing, these guys are, like, really helpful, they will aid you, your objective is to get them killed along the way. Or, that's so much more effective.
Or, just have a thing where, I don't know, have them be Avalanche sympathizers.
That's chicken shit.
That is chicken, like, shit, I mean, to be clear.
It would work better than what they did.
If I can't change anything else about this scene, like, say, developmentally, it's on my lap, it's like, okay, you can barely change anything about the scene except maybe dialogue, you could have a bit where it's just one of the guys being like, yeah, we're with you, Cloud. Like, we know what's up, and we're gonna, like, help mm-hmm. you out here. Sure, chicken shit, but I think that would make the scene make a lot more sense.
You're right. I like chicken shit, but coherent, right? Mm-hmm.
That's kind of mm-hmm. what I was going for.
Yeah, I get why they did it this way, because...
I don't.
if they gave you an objective that was like, okay, you need to make sure these people get killed on your way to the thing... Most players would interpret that as being pretty fucking villainous and would be like, oh, I'm being a terrible person right now doing this.
But you've beat up hundreds... Well, okay, you haven't really fought Shinra soldiers in this game. far as I can tell, but like you are also a eco-terrorist revolutionary fighting the evil electric company, and these people work for them.
And yeah, like it's, you know, I know that my version wouldn't happen, right? Because I do think you're right. Like, I don't think it's because, I mean, like, it is probably partially because they'd be like, wow, a lot of people would really misunderstand this. It's like, yeah, I mean, a lot of people supported fucking segregation. Eat shit. I don't fucking care. You were wrong, right? Like, if there are people who would misunderstand the politics, I know that's part of the equation for Square. It is not for me. Mm-hmm. And then, mm-hmm. But like, it's also not part of the equation for Square because it would never be on the table because they're a bunch of fucking like liberal, modern, like liberal brained idiots, right? Like mm-hmm. The politics, like I am glad this has not been a thing so far in Rebirth, but don't forget that Tifa's arc in 7 was being like, I don't know. Is terrorism bad? Should we not be trying to change things? I don't want anyone to get hurt. And it was the most cowardly shit in the world.
And Advent Children, they also have Barrett become an oil tycoon.
It's true. Forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Which might be even more severe character assassination than anything that happens in this game so far.
That is probably the worst character assassination you can do, yes. Is like... I am an eco-terrorist fighting the metaphor for killing the world because I want to do the real thing. Like, okay, cool.
Thanks.
God. So, anyway.
Well, you don't make it out. You gotta fight Roche.
Which is not a great fight.
It's not that fun.
I don't know. I had a really good time with it because it's basically how I learned to perfect parry. And once you get that down, it's a great sort of situation where he's just coming at you. You parry at the right time and you can just lay out on him. And I kind of enjoyed the motorcycle stuff, the music going on, just him being his flamboyant self because he's basically the best character that they've come up with in this whole remake trilogy.
I mean, I guess he wins by default because they've invented two characters, but sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is on the podcast with me. Hi, Kyria.
Hi.
We'll talk about you in a minute.
Uh-huh.
They've invented more than that, but I get what you mean.
I mean, they've... Go ahead.
I didn't exist before Final Fantasy VII Remake.
I love your hat.
I love it, too. That's why I wear it.
But... I mean, they have and they haven't, Jen. I mean, like, I don't think it counts as inventing a character to have, like, by the literal sense, sure, they invented, for example, the lady in Under Junon, who's, like, the leader, but she's relevant for, like, three lines of dialogue and then gone. If you don't bring the character back, then and she doesn't have any impact on the plot, then they're not real.
Yes, but there are characters who return from Remake later in this, too.
To not do anything, but yeah, to be a fun cameo and remind you of Wall Market, but we'll have that debate at that time. I'll stop. Regardless, I have been perfect parrying the whole game, and this is one of, I think, the worst implementations of it because it is not like, because you can either perfect parry him or you can spend time watching him just drive on ramps and do lightning attacks that you just roll through. Those are the only two things he does.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that, like, you are either in the mode where you're perfect parrying him and it's really easy because the timing is really simple and he just drives straight at you, or he's doing a move that you just, like, I mean, not literally, but basically mash circle and check Twitter. Like, I found it a really unengaging fight.
Mm.
See. I get if it's the moment that parrying clicked with you, it could be really cool. But yeah, ever since the Renault fight in Remake, I've started doing that, and so for me, it was not that moment.
Mm. I also love the way the fight ends, where he just dives at you with the motorcycle, and you just slice the motorcycle in half. It's so fucking cool.
I think the thing I like about Roche, I mean, he's okay fun. I think he's more your style of character than mine, mm-hmm. Jen. but he's okay fun to me. the main thing I like him for is being an active member of Soldier and showing us, like, these are what weirdos these guys can be. And also, it really puts a spotlight on everyone rolling their fucking eyes when Cloud rolls up and says he's a Soldier First Class, right? Like, you get the Turks who are like, no, I know who the Soldier First Class are. It's a short list. I have it memorized. And so for them, it's fine. But, like, when Barrett is like, really? First Class? And you're right here having a boss fight against a Soldier of Third Class and it's an even fucking fight? No, you were not. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, they just get to do whatever the fuck they want because they're that talented.
Even the, like, the, you know, bottom tier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They get to turn the boss arena into a big band jazz section. Just... Yeah, like, I like, in the moment, it's like, oh, this is kind of like a impressive sequence, but the problem is it is compounded as to what is going on in this sequence in general.
Mm-hmm.
Like, thematically.
Yeah, because after you finish the fight, if you did what all three of us did and keep them in good health, Roach gives this whole speech about how, oh, you are clearly an amazing leader of men. Here, take these gifts. You've earned them.
Here's this little keychain.
Funny, he's like, here's a keychain.
Yeah.
Funny.
That's a
yeah,
good joke.
That's good.
One of the better jokes in our play today is beating a man and he gives you a keychain of himself as a blessing.
Yeah, it's a real Gilgamesh-ass move from Fate, and I like that.
And then you get the tragic farewell between you and these fascists who thought you were cool. And I guess I figured out at a certain point that this is what we were building to, because it was clear they were too cowardly to do anything intelligent with this. Mm-hmm. But, like, what the fuck?
The wild part is he almost kills them in that scene.
Uh-huh. That would have been great.
There's the bit where they go.
That would have been great. Turn it into a combat encounter that you've been, like, tailing these guys. It's like, well, they're not going to stop following me. Time to die.
Yeah. One of them goes, hey, I think that you really are the traitor this whole time, huh? And he just readies his sword and is like, okay, sorry, I have to do this. And then the guy goes, whoa.
Funny joke,
don't
sir.
Don't take the joke this far. Yeah.
Everybody knows that the traitor is a Wu Tai lady. And it's like, well, she wasn't in uniform, and you know that there's someone in uniform. Okay, whatever.
Whatever.
This is dumb. Will we ever see you again, sir? Like, and of course you will. Of course you will. Of course, like, at the end of fucking, you know, like, Final Fantasy VII, like, reunion, which is what they're going to call it, mm-hmm, you're going to have, like, a moment where Sephiroth is calling Meteor and the Turks are fighting alongside you and Shinra's like, do whatever you got to do. And here's the seventh and they've got your back, sir. And I'm just furious.
Yeah.
It's funny because I came in here expecting to just dish on a particular bit of character interaction that I just fucking hate, and I expected the rest of it to go smooth, but no, it turns out that y'all had even more issues with characters than I did.
This is a really like, I should save it. Let's get on a ship.
Let's get on a ship and let's play some fucking Queen's Blood.
Yeah, but before Queen's Blood, that I experienced the moment where I finally realized I hate the way they're portraying Tifa and Aerith in this game, because there's this bit where they're just hiding behind boxes and they're just like, you want to talk business? What business? Boys. And then immediately after giggling for a second, they go, Cloud walks up and they go, we'll talk about business later. And it just made me realize there's a little bit of this, but not much at all in Remake. It's happening all the time in Rebirth, so I'm convinced someone in the executive pool saw how online there's whole shipping wars between fans of Cloud and Aerith and Cloud and Tifa. And they decided, we gotta nip this in the bud, because throughout the game, you will just have moments like at the first Chocobo Ranch or at this in the ship where suddenly the two of them start acting in sync and finishing each other's sentences and acting in ways that completely go against any bits of their character. They're just fucking animatronics in this game, and it is, it's the worst. Every time it happens, I hate what is going on screen.
I don't think they're nipping anything in the bud. I don't think that's what's happening in theater. I think it's just intensely misogynist portrayal of women. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh, you know, girls giggling, talking about boys. Of course, the term they use in Japanese is hatsukoi, first loves, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, it is fine if you want to have this be a side of these characters to a certain extent. If you want to have it be like these two are getting along really well, and you also want to have it be like, you know, the girls talk about romance. I mean, you know, it is literally having a scene exclusively dedicated to failing the Bechdel test, but what can you do?
What can you do?
The Bechdel test was never intended as a cure, you know, of all purpose, whatever. But like, it is just like rough. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree with you. I think it sucks. I think like there is a degree of recharacterizing Aerith, at least compared to, you know, the English script of Final Fantasy VII, which I know the Japanese did some different characterization stuff with how things were termed. In this, she is more of a normal but like flirty girl, right? In Seven, she was a lot more, like, playfully, but, like, obstinate and confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where I like it, right? There's times where Aerith is like, wait, are you saying people are stupid if they believe the news? And it's like, yes, Aerith. Yes, that is what we're saying from our last episode, right? When, mm-hmm. when she's, you know, Barrett saying that the news is dumb, right? Like, I think it's actually kind of good to have this side of her that is just like, I mean, you know, she's a descendant of the ancients. She's also just a girl who grew up in this society and never questioned it. And that makes her kind of dumb in ways. Mm-hmm. But like,
that could make her even more compelling to a certain degree of having her forced to confront these things that she had previously thought.
But like, why are we stealing like already tired bits from harem anime? What are we doing?
And it's also just like, these characters' lives didn't used to revolve around Cloud, and they sure do now in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it's kind of harder to understand than ever, why? Why isn't Barrett leading the party?
He's the fucking leader.
He's the fucking leader, and Cloud, like, Cloud has the most, like, fucking, like, Blue Ranger position here.
Absolutely.
Where he's like, oh, he's like the very, like, very skilled and, like, dedicated at combat and angry and wants revenge on the main antagonist, but has no fucking plan or leadership skills. Like, why is he in charge?
Like, he can still be a compelling protagonist while not being the leader of this little crew we have.
And the moments where they let Barrett be a leader, it's great.
Yeah.
There have been two of them.
Anytime they lean into that, it's like, fuck yeah, Barrett.
Yeah. He is the person who has an idea of what needs to happen and the will to do it and has made sacrifices. And meanwhile, Cloud is here like, well, you know, I hallucinate that I was cool once. Like, cool.
Cool, man.
Good for you. And I don't think that makes Cloud a bad character. I just don't know why they're putting him in this position. I just don't get it.
Yeah, even in the case of, because he is the player character, you could just have it be where Barrett makes a suggestion, or not a suggestion, makes a leadership decision, and then Cloud is like, all right, that seems like a good plan, boss, and you carry it out.
Yeah. But it's time to play cards.
It's time to play cards.
On the weirdest fucking cross between a cruise ship and a worker ship that I've ever seen. Because you have the ship on the outside is very much decked out like a cruise ship. But then you look at the cabins people are sleeping in and it's just fucking basic hammocks. Like
you head downstairs from the fucking like from a casino in Vegas into the fucking Obra Dinn. It's so bizarre.
It's so weird. You would expect that to be like at least two decks down, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you wouldn't expect parents with families to be like, all right, kids, pick out your hammock.
He's up on the deck, Richie Rich, down below decks on for the Red October. Like, what's happening?
God.
it's like, that is not a problem. It's stupid. It's kind of funny how stupid it is. I don't think it actually, like, I'm not actually going to sit here and be like, this is one of the big press, just like, this is so stupid, you guys.
Yeah, it's just a very funny example of them trying to, like, gussy up a element from the original that was just very much, okay, we're infiltrating this ship that a bunch of workers are going to be on, and we're going to get from A to B, but because they have to prolong every bit of the game to make it fit across three games. Time for a Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournament arc.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it works for me because it is such, like, the concept of these remakes, as you say, is largely padding things out and having the most, like, Goku and Piccolo getting their driver's license episode ever in the middle of this game, where it's like Red 13 dresses up as a Shinra soldier so he can play Yu-Gi-Oh! I'm like, all right, this is dumb enough. You did it this time.
That actually did kind of work when you get to the end of the tournament and you defeat the girl at the beginning who have that scene of like, I guess we'll see each other on the battlefield style like rivalry. And then
she's one of the easiest fights of the tournament.
Yeah, and
maybe that was just me, but
it took me a few tries, but I got there.
And then Red 13 shows up and the music goes into fucking overdrive, and then Cloud looks at the camera being like, let's play, and throws a card at the camera.
it is stupid enough. I also appreciate Red 13 being like, so what's up, are you man enough? And Cloud says, no, I'm leaving. And then everyone else around him is like, yeah, they're playing. It's like, okay.
And once again, this is another Japanese game in which you have like one of your characters doing Michael Jackson dance moves.
Yeah, that is true. It was a strange choice.
I did like the line from Red 13 talking about, like, you could act humanoid enough with enough flamboyance.
Even though, like, he makes a little child cry.
Yeah.
It's a fun bit, and it's fun to kind of reconnect with some of the other side characters, just, like, seeing Andrea, and he's like, yeah, this isn't for dancing this time, though if I win, who knows?
I instead chose to battle Madame M in that moment.
I did,
and
as
she
well.
Did not have much interesting to say.
Yeah.
She was mostly just sort of like sulky and pouty.
Mm. Yeah. And he also had the visual gag where every time you go to the guy to report your winnings, he gets another bit of Cloud memorabilia to celebrate your streak.
That's an okay gag. I like that.
It's all right. It's all right. Yeah.
I like gags that are very low key.
I sometimes like gags that are pretty high key, but you know, I like when you compartmentalize your absurdity into places that doesn't subvert the characters as people.
Mm-hmm.
not the strong suit of this game.
Right.
I think the side content is actually some of the strongest bits of story in this, just because, like, it's y'all just doing random shit and bonding over that.
Well, we'll have that conversation in a minute, because we're almost done with our main plot for the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Spoilers, I don't agree with you.
Fair enough.
You go down below deck after the tournament, And then monsters attack, and it's the things from the fucking from the reactors in Nibelheim, and they're fusing with the men in black cloaks to form super men in black cloaks. And then you fight fucking Genova, and yeah.
It's a whole thing.
The section of the game occurs.
You do get a cutscene where we have the captain of the ship reporting to Hojo about what is going on, and then Hojo makes some like comments of like, oh, make sure to identify your body for me. And then, you know, it moves on.
Which is, we would have been so much better off without that scene.
I'm going to say something here that will be okay, weird to folks.
Okay, leading back.
It'll be weird to folks familiar with the original Final Fantasy VII. I just kind of enjoy it whenever Hojo shows up in these remakes because he is so cartoonish and over the top, and he has the best fucking sinister facial expressions while he's going through all this stuff. It's very clear why Sephiroth hates this motherfucker, and it's just fun to see him occasionally show up and chew scenery for a bit.
I couldn't disagree more. I think Hojo is... other than, like, things that are, like, actively bigoted, I think he is the worst character in these games. He is not a person, and every time he interacts with anyone, he doesn't act like a person. He just acts like the word evil written on a wavy tube man, and I can't fucking stand him.
He is so cartoonishly evil that it is difficult for me to... for like the type of story that this game is trying to tell, in theory, about revolutionaries, about eco-terrorism, about like the death of the planet and things like that, that you have this wacky, evil, mad scientist man doing a Dr. Wily voice sort of thing going on, is counterintuitive at the most generous.
And his shtick, like, his behavior is so incoherent that it doesn't work for anything better than G.I. Joe. Like, even if you are like, I'm going to use these people as my test, this is a stupid way to do it.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. And I also, when you mentioned that stuff, I do think that between the two of them, Heidegger is the more entertaining one, just because he's also sort of supposed to be the public face of everything, and he often has to deal with trying to be a respectable public face while also just wanting to get into his weird bloodlust situations.
And, like, Heidegger, it's like, I mean, here, the other thing is, if we're talking about, like, cartoonish, like, archetypes... the evil scientist man is kind of based on nothing, right? And it can be fun, but it's just a whole cloth fictional invention, right? Mm-hmm. The evil businessman is just every fucking businessman.
Exactly.
So it plays better in a serious story. You can do comedy and serious because these people, we all know these people.
They unfortunately run our lives.
It would be too on the nose, but effectively, in a world where we didn't know him already, you could replace Heidegger with Elon Musk and it would still just fucking work. So I think Heidegger is funnier, but also he just integrates better with moments where they need to take things seriously because he is a form of evil that is extremely real.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the person who's like... make sure to put a note on your foot so I can identify the body for science. It's like, okay, well, first of all, that's bad science. Wouldn't you want alive subjects for that makes way more sense? Wouldn't it make way more sense to like send a spec ops team and like kidnap people than just go collect gore? But also, what is any of this? I really, really think Hojo is one of the biggest examples of how incompetent their writing can be.
Yeah, fair enough.
But that's it. That's it for today. We have the captain shoot the black cloaks in the head, which honestly, like, yeah. I mean,
He's making a command decision.
And it's something that everyone should be doing. I mean, that's the other thing is, everyone except for the party, when push comes to shove, just shoots these guys. Even the Turks, who are like, man, we got to figure out what's up with these guys. And then Singh is like, eh, I'm sick of this, and just shoots them. Which is like, okay, well then why were you keeping them alive in the first place? Like, shooting them doesn't solve the situation. You just shot them because you can. I don't understand why these characters are, like, in anywhere near the central part of this plot whatsoever. This whole, like, main arc of the story, 3, 4, 5, has just been such a whiff for me.
It's not great. It is, while on some level when I was watching many of these cutscenes, I felt like I was missing information, which is fine. Like, I watch shows all the time in which there is information that is missing due to not me seeing previous stuff all the time, or just the way it's written. But I just have a hard time. Like, this whole plot with the black-robed men, like, it would be one thing if they... Imagine a scenario in which we just don't see that. Like, if we saw them less often, they'd be more effective. Like, just have them be in the shadows or in the corners that you find, right? Like, because in the original game, from what it sounds like, you just see them in dark places and you're like, oh, what the fuck is going on here? But here it's I feel like tonally, I don't think they have not nailed why I should care about this plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just don't think I had as much of a problem with the trimmings as either of you did. Though I do have some major problems, as I talked about with the Aerith and Tifa stuff.
Mm-hmm. But it's time to talk about everything else, right?
Open world stuff.
Open world stuff, combat stuff, just, you know, the parts that aren't the main plot.
Wow, 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 wow.
That, okay. See, they can make good songs when they want to.
I love the way that there's a combat version of it, too.
Yeah, so there's a quest where you are escorting a dog who is carrying money, and the whole time there is this, like, peppy, fun little song with a children's children's choir going bow wow wow nonstop. It's great. It's terrific.
It's very good. You do, like, yeah, as you are running across the map, escorting this, I thought it was a whippet for a second, like, which is a type of dog that is like a very small greyhound. It kind of looks like salmon. Kind of looks like that, but I digress.
I certainly don't know what species it's supposed to be. What breed? I don't know this stuff. But yeah, it does look kind of whippity.
Yeah. One of the doctors that I work with at my job has a whippet that she brings to work every now and again. So I thought of that dog while escorting Salmon. Which Salmon is also a good name for a dog.
It is.
But then you do have this protracted bit of Barret. Like, it's played for comedy in the Japanese. Him just being like lamenting, like, oh, will I ever be able to give up Marlene?
They lean into it a little too hard, but I fundamentally think it works for me because the way he presents it, like, you know, we're doing this job for this lady who kind of like is having trouble letting go of her son, and this is her final bid to let her son go, who's sort of run off and lived his own life. And he's like, obviously, like, Barret's like, obviously, that's a bad way to do this, right? You need to understand that your kids are their own people, and you need to learn to let go. And when I grow up, or no, sorry,
when Marlene,
when Marlene grows up, what she wants to do with her life, I just, you know, I'm going to respect it and let her go. and I just, you know, take my hands off. And she's like, do you believe me? And Glutz says, absolutely not. And he's like, right? I don't either. And I feel that moment, I was like, it is being played as a joke, but it is kind of a, it is an in-universe joke. It is a self-effacing joke of Barrett being like, it's so easy to say you're going to do the right thing, but God damn it, I love my girl. And I'm like, yeah. All right.
Yeah, it's like a good character bit.
Yeah, and by the time the money gets to them, it leads to this good moment where he finally takes that energy and puts it to use where the, basically, the son doesn't want to accept the money at all because he's trying to raise a family. And Barrett's like, well, you have a kid now, and I imagine you want the best life possible for this kid. So do what I would do and just take the money.
Yeah, I believe the line that he says is something to the effect of raising a kid isn't cheap.
Yeah, it's all but do you know how much formula costs?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I
do like, again, a little bit of like his charisma coming in where he goes like, if you don't want the money, I'll take it. And that instantly yeah. makes him it really instantly makes the sun fold.
Yeah, it is. I think it is a good bit of like, and you know, Barrett is right here, right? It's like, no, I get you are having a dumb, stupid thing with your mom and that's your business, but like, you need to set aside your pride for the sake of your kid here.
Yeah. The scene, like, that was the moment, like, the scene did win me over at that point. I just felt that you could have had the joke be, like, punctuate with, like, in the middle of it, have Cloud going, like, I don't believe you. Like, have that moment. And then play it for just a like, it's already an inherently funny scene with the ba-wa-wa, you know, things like that. And I'm glad they played it for, not for drama, that feels like the wrong word in here, but they take their own premise seriously for a second mm-hmm. here, and I appreciate that. It feels like it is written by someone who is a parent.
And I do think, like, I think you are getting at something that I agree with, which is that, like, there is a natural comedy to this that works. There is a serious side to it that works. And ultimately, I think they like, have a good beat and then end on the right beat. I do think they lean into the joke a little too hard in the middle.
Mm-hmm. That was kind
where
of
it's
my
just,
beef
you know,
with
like,
it.
Right, where it is just, like, Barrett, like, doing increasingly theatric, like, wailing about his sweet little girl. And it is like, okay, this is getting to a point that is like not it is not flattering to the character anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, and after that high note, I did, and the immediate next thing I did was I went into the little Moogle hut where you have to chase down these Moogles who are throwing Mario Kart banana peels at you.
Yeah, so first of all, the Moogles in this game look horrifying.
Yep. They're not cute.
They have teeth.
Hey, quick question. Why did the Moogle have teeth?
It's they have teeth. They are like teddy bears with wings that are also, like, especially in the mouth area, like 3-year-old kids.
Yeah, they kind of have like a buck tooth sort of thing going
on. Yeah.
I read it as like a weird mix between a teddy bear and a koala, especially with the facial structure.
They're so stretched out, though. They are lanky.
Mm-hmm.
They are long Mario.
I saw a tweet going around at one point that was like, me and my buddies would have beat these Moogles with hammers, I'll tell you what.
I just think it is that, like, you know, whatever. They can do what they want. I don't think this was the right call.
It's weird when I can take a look at the Moogles in Final Fantasy 16, a game that almost didn't have Moogles because they were worried it wouldn't let them take the world seriously. And even those ones have a less off-putting design than this one right here.
I'm going to look up what they look like real quick. If my browser would allow me to do anything, thank you, Android, for being a piece of shit.
Have you got your answer?
Yeah, I got my answer. They just look like Moogles.
Yeah, they look like puffy little cats. It's cute.
It's what they should have stuck with.
Yeah, this is pretty much, I mean, there are some people involved that worked on Final Fantasy XIV. It is their Final Fantasy XIV design, so it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's the Moogle stuff where you're chasing these things, and it is actually, I feel like you can see some Final Fantasy XIV in this, ironically, because the way, like, this, the ground targeted AoEs and stuff is all very much like, oh, this is like a baby version of FF14 boss mechanics. And then, yeah, what other open world stuff?
I found this
Fort Condor.
I don't think I went there yet. But
okay, I guess I'll save that. Go ahead then.
I'll just say I did find my first scenic location because I encountered snaps in Lower Junon because I didn't encounter them in Calm, but the quest starts regularly anyway. I don't know. It was kind of fun to go to that boat that was washed ashore and take pictures.
I understand why it's there, but it's a strange choice to not have it maybe disappear when you go into photo mode or something. The huge plaque that is like, here is a pretty place. And I'm like, well, it's less pretty with this fucking sign in the way.
that getting to that particular boat was actually a big issue that I have with the traversal in this game, where it's something I noticed in the Grasslands first, where I was trying to chase down the whole Burke's Badasses quest line, and they happened to get on a different half of this sort of giant divide between the City of Calm and the Grasslands, and I just could not for the life of me find my way over there, despite like being a few hundred meters away from the location, and That also kind of happens here, because if you approach the boat from the wrong side of the cliff, you just can't get there. You have to go all the way back and then through the city and then make your approach again.
I think I do agree with you. I think they did a bad job with this. In this particular instance, it is partially because they are trying to gate you as far as how far along you are in the chapter, because you have to have done the quest, you know, escorting Salmon in order to do this. Which doesn't unlock immediately. They don't want you doing this this and a couple of other activities right when you get to the Junon area. But they certainly don't tell you that. There are certainly some things that are just on the map that you cannot figure out how to fucking reach, and they don't tell you literally can't. And then, again, once you can, the navigation is weird, and it's easy to go the wrong way and get fucked over. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. And you would think, like, okay, one of the things that seems to be established, and they I think they mentioned this in the Grasslands area, is this idea that you have to unlock the regional chocobo. And in this region, you can only use the chocobo for climbing the, you know, a painted vertical cliffs. And I just felt like, I don't know, this game's open world design is frustrating, but to a certain degree you can alleviate some of that frustration of not, like, telegraphing you can't get to a point by, say, oh, if I unlock one regional chocobo, I can take it to another region, right? Like, have those vertical cliffs in the Grasslands and just be like, oh, you can't traverse these, but then you unlock the regional chocobo in Juon and you're like, oh, okay, I can go back to the Grasslands and access those locations again.
I don't think I want that, personally. Like, this can be an area where we just feel differently, but, like, I like having chocobos that are, like, customized to the location you're in to give areas different vibes. It's like, okay, this is a mountainous area, so verticality is a big issue here. I know we're gonna get, like, just knowing Final Fantasy VII and the types of chocobos that exist in that game, I'm certain we're gonna get to a place where we need a chocobo who can run on water, right? And so it'll be a watery place or whatever. I think having chocobos have a regional gimmick and keeping it to that region helps give region an identity.
That's fair.
Agreed.
I just feel like you can alleviate some of the frustration of, can I even go to a location, by having those markers, but I hear what you're saying.
Well, mm-hmm. but I don't think it would do it because, like, I mean, for with the Burke's badasses thing, the issue is there's a weird, like, shortcut underneath the city you have to take. Like, there's, like, a fenced off area.
Oh, okay. That's how you get there?
Yeah, there's a spot that gets, I don't know when it gets marked on your map, but there's a spot that gets marked on your map of, like, a weird, like businessman's, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you go there, and there's, like, a fence, and you unlock the fence and go through. It's, yeah. It's not, it is just, it feels insufficiently tested. Or, you know, things are almost never the tester's fault. So correct. I should say insufficient response to the testing.
Yeah. Because I can't imagine we're the only ones having trouble getting around like this.
No, absolutely not. And yeah, it would be way better if there was some more signposting about what you could and couldn't do. And, you know, not super bad, but there's a degree to which this game came in hot, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it may get patched.
It has trouble running on the latest generation of consoles.
And it's just like, you know, it was a huge game. It was a huge project and they had a hard release date. And anytime that happens, you know, it's like, well, they would have liked more time.
This is also the chapter where towers broke for me because I got into a situation where, okay, I was approaching a tower by the cliffside and there happened to be three enemies with wings, like three different birds. And I was like, okay, not a problem. I'll just fight them. They seem pretty tough, but it'll be fine. I'll get through them.
Oh, yes, this. Yeah.
And all three of them have wind attacks. So I would get to a point where I take like 25 to 50% of their health down, they would blast me out of their specific range, which is very tiny. And once I got blasted out and ran back into the combat area, they were fully healed again. It's like, what the fuck?
Right, because they blast you far enough that it triggers the fleeing thing and thinks you're trying to run from the battle and then kicks them out. Your health stays where it was, theirs resets.
Yes, and that is just infuriating.
This is not to excuse it. If you come into this again, there is a solution, which is just to position yourself so that if you're blown away, you are blown further into their space. It sucks that that's what you have to do. That is how I solved it, is by being like, okay, if you knock me back, you're just knocking me back further into the arena as opposed to away. Mm-hmm. It is very obnoxious. Fighting those enemies was fucking annoying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when they're all ganged up like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some enemies who are not very fun to fight. I think there are a couple of the birds, like, they're the birds that do that. They have, like, the AoE, wind knockback. They also have this dive where, I don't know what the secret is to this one, because it's an exclamation mark move, which means it's unblockable, so you can't parry it. But also, I can't seem to roll through it, because if I roll, they just keep flying and then hit me as soon as I end my recovery frames. So it just seems like I'm guaranteed to lose 500 health every time they use that move, which is obnoxious.
If I had to guess, maybe it expects you to interrupt them with something that slightly fills their pressure meter or something.
Well, that didn't seem to work, but I don't know. Maybe I fucked up the timing or something. I don't know. It's
what a mysterious
ultimately
game.
Not a big deal.
Kyrie ran into something I didn't, which is you finally get your first bit of sheet music in the basically the rebel hideout that you visit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I haven't run into any of this.
Okay, so what happens is I am in that rebel base and I'm doing some exploring. I am just, you know, farting around in town, seeing what's there, and I find a piano, and I had heard about the piano stuff in this game, that, or I knew that you could play a piano. I did not realize there was a rhythm game attached to it, because what happens is if you find sheet music, I found my first sheet music on the piano itself. Mm-hmm. It then goes into a rhythm game where it uses the left and right sticks in the way that you can play the piano normally in this game. And it grades your performance, and there's a maestro next to the piano that if you get an A rank or higher, he'll give you stuff.
Huh.
Yeah, I thought this was just one of those vestigial development things that was fun for the development team to put in, which of course they would turn it into a quest line. But yeah, I ran into that and I got to play the overworld theme. Like the traditional overworld theme.
What was it fun?
It was a little frustrating because the way you interface with this rhythm game is you have the two circles for your left stick and right stick, and you basically have to not flick, but press the stick in the direction of where the line is going to play the note.
So, I can see that getting frustrating. It seems like a good control scheme as far as giving you a lot of notes you can play, but it doesn't seem like it would be super precise.
I mean, it has like a wide radius, but it's still not super precise.
Yeah, I've seen it mostly used to do various jokey things online, like
play the opening.
Jackson uploaded a video where they were playing the opening bit to Welcome to the Black Parade.
Or you have people just making Cloud play the opening notes to Megalomania.
Sure. You know, the stuff you get every time there's an instrument in games where people are like, I did the Simpsons theme.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that to insult you. It just doesn't particularly interest me. You, in this case, being whoever is uploading their video of like, check it out. I did, you know, chopsticks. I'm like, okay. I'm glad you had fun with that. I'm not particular. I don't want to get anything out of this, but, you know, that's fine.
I do appreciate how fully featured the piano is. Like, there's ways to change octaves. There's ways to modify the notes. They do their best to make it, like, if you know your stuff, you can just play this like a piano.
Hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I ran into that. I saw the grade requirement for the item, and I was just like, I'll mess with you later, if I mess with you at all.
Mm-hmm. Other open world stuff. Jen mentioned the Burke's Badasses stuff, which is actually from chapter one, but we never talked about it. Or not chapter one, our first podcast from chapter two, mm-hmm. our first podcast. Mm-hmm. We never talked about it. It is one of the proto relic quests that it seems like each region has, so we'll talk about both of those. It is the bandits who were sort of like minor characters during like sort of the Wall Market part of Remake, and now they're treasure hunters and you harass them a bunch to get treasure that they found
while Chadley is a dick to you, just being like, huh, I guess you didn't take him out this time, huh, Cloud? You keep doing this and they keep getting away. Wonder what's happening.
I did like the comment that Cloud had to snap back at that. It's like, I'm letting them lead us to their location, to their hideout. You can track them anyway, Chadley.
And did you complete this one, Jen?
As mentioned, I didn't find the way underneath the town, but I will say that was already one of my favorite little songs in Remake. The way that they mix the original Wall Market theme into this interesting sort of like electric thing going on. And they push that even further when you're fighting them here, and it fucking rocks.
I do appreciate, like, I was kind of off put for most of the quest, because obviously in Remake, they are bandits, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're bandits that you encounter and you beat up and you take their shit. Mm-hmm. And here they found a piece of treasure and you're like, give it to me. It's mine now or I'll fucking kill you. And it's like, what right do you have to this? Remind me of that. and you do have the option. I don't know what happens if you don't take it, because I just took it. But at the end, you do have the option when you finally track them down and they're like, hey, man, we didn't steal this. We found treasure. And you can be like, I'll buy it from you. And they're like, yeah, OK, fair enough. And they'll sell it to you. You also have the option of being like, no, I won't buy it from you. I don't know what happens then. Probably you do some shitty thing.
Yeah, you probably just beat the shit out of them again.
Yeah, probably. That is, yeah, you get a proto relic, and you get a little, like, you get briefly transported to an alternate dimension where you see Gilgamesh.
Oh.
Oh, did you not get this? Oh, right, of course, you didn't finish it. You just said this. Yeah. You get briefly transported to an alternate dimension where you see Gilgamesh. I did this second after I did the other proto relic one, and it seems like the order matters somewhat, like not ultimately, but you get slightly different scenes. So what I first did was the Fort Condor proto relic ones. You find a board game version of this, is the board game Fort Condor, which was a mini game in the original, and in intermission they
intergrade, intergrade,
whatever. Well, intergrade is the release. Intermission is the sub portion within Intergrade. There is this mini game exists where it's like a sort of a reverse tower defense thing, and your characters get sucked into the board game, and you have to win to escape, and there's the proto relic, and you can win the proto relic, and Gilgamesh is there as one of the characters in the board game. But then near the end, you start to think, wait, maybe he's not just a character in a board game. I had a miserable time with this. I think it is an incredibly inflexible strategy game where there are basically like one or two solutions, is how it came across to me. It's like there are right builds and most builds are wrong. It's just a fucking annoying game to me. But I did beat it, and you get a proto relic there, and then you examine it and you are transported to an alternate realm where it's like, wait, it's Gilgamesh. Weren't you the captain from the board game? And he's like, oh, I see. You are a mighty warrior, finally a worthy challenge. And then there's a comedy beat where you just like effortlessly dodge him, and he's like, ah, and runs away. When I got the second one, it was like, okay, I'd already gotten the first one, so I load in. And Chadley, by the way, this whole time is like monitoring you, and he's like, you keep getting sucked into this board game. That's really fucking weird. And he's like, oh, you got sucked somewhere else this time. This time I load in, and then like a VR Chadley appears, and he's like, I figured out how to follow you. This is weird. And you see Gilgamesh again, and Chadley pisses him off, and they have a little fight. It seems like what is going to happen is I will keep having these little scenes, and then once you've done all the proto relic quests, you'll probably have a boss fight against Gilgamesh.
That tracks.
Yeah, and basically turn him into a summon or something.
Something. Yeah. That's a side activity you can do.
Yeah. Did you do the stuff with Kyrie?
I did, unfortunately, do the stuff with Kyrie. So in region one, she's claiming she's a mercenary, and she's going to repair the Mako pipeline. This one is pretty straightforward. It's just like, okay, collect some nails and she'll fix the pipe. And Cloud is like, don't call yourself a merc anymore. And she's like, okay, psych, I'm going to keep doing it.
And then she keeps doing it.
Uh-huh. And you see her in Judon, and she's like, I've taken over this abandoned like radio tower, and I'm advertising my merc business.
I'm advertising with this obnoxious song.
And you're like, stop. And she's like, I'm not going to do that.
Oh, now they're like, monsters.
Okay. And then you fight a bunch of flans, and it's obnoxious. And I hope you brought Aerith. Because she's the only one whose auto attacks do normal damage against them.
Does Cloud also point out that, hey, people were using this building?
I don't recall that.
Okay, because you do find out about her because the leader of the rebel encampment, I'll go back to in a moment because I have some stuff to say about them. he's basically like, yeah, there's this girl that basically took over a building that we've been using because she thought no one was using it. Could you just go and kick her out somewhat? Because you mentioned that you know her.
Yeah.
But, yep. The people there, they just lean hard on the ineffectual action angle, and it kind of sucks sometimes. Like, there's someone that you can play at Queen's Blood there who's like, yeah, I'm going to overthrow Shinra by using Queen's Blood to get an opportunity to talk with people. Go out, fair gamer, and keep playing Queen's Blood so it can get to this point.
Yeah. And it's just a house of like wannabe revolutionaries with no spine, which, given the game's politics so far on revolutionaries, is, as you say, not ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they basically treat the area is supposed to be like a commune of sorts that's also just gearing up to be resistance, and they treat the commune stuff as a complete joke, except for like they do have a bit where this woman hits on another woman, and that's initially kind of funny because of her surprise at just being like, oh, I didn't even know you thought of me that way. And the thing is, it keeps happening every time you cross that area, so that gets old pretty quick.
I don't know. I have a few nice things to say about like some of the optional boss fights. Like there's a, if you do all the hunts in the Junon area, you fight a fucking mind flayer.
Oh.
And that fight is actually kind of fun. It is a decently challenging and engaging boss fight. So I had some fun with that. But yeah.
I forget if I mentioned this previous episode, but I did enjoy fighting the Quetzalcoatl in the grasslands.
That fight was okay. I was unfortunately, by the time I got back to that one, I was so overleveled that it was a complete nothing of a fight, but
Yeah, that makes sense.
What, bit of a shame.
What I might do before our next recording is I kind of want to do some open world cleanup.
Do you? If you're doing this to be thorough, I got you covered. I'll do this stuff. It sounds like you don't fucking like it, which is so fair.
I don't love it. I don't love it. But
I don't know. Take care of yourself. We have a lot of game to go. We have a lot of episodes to record, and it's going to keep doing things to piss us off, even without you doing side content you expressly don't enjoy.
I am both excited and nervous for Chapter 6 because we're finally getting to the Costa del Sol stuff, and this has been the segment I've been looking forward to ever since the remake project started. Like, oh, I bet they're going to do some cool stuff with this. They're going to turn it into a whole lengthy beach episode, and it's the one area where I'm like, yeah, this being a little bit longer, that'd be kind of fun. But I guess I'll see whether I was right or very wrong once we get to that.
This is going to be the chapter where you see Tifa in the terrible dress, and this is the chapter where Cloud loses his house.
Yeah. So,
oh boy.
Next time, is it just one chapter for our next recording?
I believe it's just... Is that wrong?
Check the pin.
According to the setup we have, our next thing is episodes 6 through 8.
Oh, okay.
Or chapter 6 through 8. After that is the one that's just one chapter.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Wow, we're going to spend a while at Costa Del... Because the way Jackson has very thoughtfully broken this up for us is by open world segment. And so... We're going to be at Costa del Sol for a while, I guess.
We're going to see Ichiban just kind of like surfing on the coastline.
Both of these games give you a fake segue.
I hope Cloud changes class to surfer.
Hell yeah.
Hope we see Alan Wake fixing his whole shit with a dolphin.
We did early in our playthrough, we did have Cloud interacting with a dolphin. So
that's true. We did. Bigger picture, right? These chapters were such a letdown to me because it feels like the interviews they gave after Remake were true, right? Where they're like, we will. Final Fantasy VII Remake was a game that ended by them like asking permission of themselves and then giving themselves permission to make changes. And then the interviews afterwards were them saying, like, but don't worry, the changes won't be that big a deal. And that was true. They are going to... We have gotten zero more of Zack. And every time a major plot divergence happens, it is immediately snuffed out. Oh man, we're going to form a truce with Shinra? No. that's not going to happen. Yuffie's going to, like, nip this one in the bud. Or, like, oh, like, Tifa is actually going to confront Cloud about the fact that his story isn't true? No, it's going to be an awkward conversation. They'll drop it and not pick it back up again for 10 chapters.
They'll have another awkward conversation, but then they're just going to, like, oh, they're just going to scoot it away for now.
And it just is really disappointing to me.
There's also a bit that keeps coming up that makes me wonder if I'm forgetting something or I missed a crucial bit within Remake initially, because you just have these conversations between Tifa and Aerith where they're like, yeah, so that thing kind of just removed my memories about the specific situation, and they mention a character name that I don't recognize at all.
What character name?
I can't even tell you. Like, I saw the character name being mentioned, and I was like, who the fuck is that?
I mean, they're the Whispers? Is that what you mean?
No, they mention how the Whispers has been taking stuff away from them in certain memories, and then they mention a specific character name that I did not recognize at all.
Huh. I don't remember this detail.
Me neither.
But, yeah, I mean, they have mentioned that, like... Well, we may have defeated fate, but in the process, fate took away our ability to make changes. So did we defeat fate? Cool.
Cool. Thanks, guys. We'll have to find out as we keep playing.
Yeah, play to find out what happens.
Let's hope that the next few chapters are much better.
I am having fun, so I imagine I will have fun regardless. But I do not expect things to get better.
Fair enough.
I think that's it for this particular episode.
Indeed. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll go ahead and do plug zone here. Kyrie, where can people find you and your stuff?
You can find me in Junon running the worst mercenary board you've ever seen on Twitter at Kyrie A Page. Or co-host to just Kyrie Page.
Jen, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter at JBU3. You can find me on co-host where I'm a bit more active as Jen-and-Aster. And you can find my account, which I barely use at all these days, for Blue Sky under the name Spooky Cute Witch.
So you can find me on Twitter at SixDetmar. DMs are open there for any questions, comments, listener requests, that sort of thing. I am using it less and less. I also have a co-host at the same address, but I'm actually not using that one too much more either. So
one of the best ways to contact us will be emails at scanlinemedia.com.
That's a good one. And also, I mean, I do, anytime someone DMs me, I don't think it's ever taken me more than 10 hours to respond. That's if I'm unconscious, right? I will get back to you pretty quick, so... But, yeah, I think that's it for this episode. As Jen mentioned, as Kyrie mentioned, we will be back with 6, 7, 8 for next time. And then we'll finally get a short one after that. But, yeah, I can only hope that I see Red 13 in a really sexy swimsuit.
One can hope.
I was a little sad when the Shinra cosplay is very funny, but I was sad that we didn't get to see him in his sailor outfit from the PS1 just doing his little animation.
It's true. It was cute. Maybe there's still time. And for better or worse, the unknown journey continues. Peace out.
See ya.
Later.